Hi, I'm Vic Schoenbeck, and I'm sitting here with Dr. Bill Jenkins, a distinguished alumnus of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and a graduate of the Department of Epidemiology at UNC, and a good friend of mine, and he has many other recognitions that we'll talk about. Today is October the 29th, 2014, and the purpose of this interview was to find out more about his background, his family background, how he found his way to epidemiology. So, Bill, thank you so much doing this interview.
Thank you for inviting me.
Tell me about your early years, your family. Okay. You were telling me your family came from South Carolina.
Yes. Well, my maternal family were Geechee. They originally were indigo and rice growers on the island, Polly's Island, South Carolina. Probably had been there prior to 1700, from all we can understand. And remained on that island until the Civil War, when my great-grandfather joined the 1st Regiment, the 1st Black Regiment in the Civil War. The 1st South Carolina Volunteers fought for those 4 years, and then...
Excuse me, on which side?
Union.
Union, just wanted to make sure.
Fought the secession, as, he, as
didn't
they would say.
The Union was recruiting in South Carolina.
Yes. Oh, along the coast, anyway. Only along the coast.
Okay.
Yes. And they, after the Civil War, they were mustered out near Charleston, South Carolina, on Wagner's Fort Wagner, near Charleston, South Carolina, but settled on a peninsula called Mount Pleasant in a community called Greenwich, where the nurse for the regiment started a Quaker school. And so my family's been going to that school for a number of generations. So that's my maternal side. On my maternal side, they came to this country later.
Your paternal side?
My paternal side.
Okay.
Yeah. They came to this country later. They, a young woman from the Gambia region whose family were caught in a drought. And her family sold her into slavery in order to save the rest of the family at around 10 or 11 years of age. And then she came here to the United States on a ship called the Hannah, and so that's the name she took when she, or the name they gave her, I don't know which, when she landed in on Sullivan's Island, South Carolina in 1811. And she was sold to the Kirkland Plantation, which is a very famous American family, of course, and ended up, in a relationship that I assume was married, since they were together for 47 years, to a Scottish indentured servant, and started a family.
So this was a biracial marriage?
Yeah, I guess so.
In the pre-Civil War era?
I guess so.
In South Carolina?
In South Carolina. I think that has happened several times in my family history. The one family that several books have been written about is a family in which a woman, Elise, I think was her name, took the name Halston, was in a relationship with one of the brothers of the largest slaveholding family in America, the Ball family, more than 26,000 slaves. And they had a relationship over a 20 or 30 year period, and is now acknowledged as part of the Ball, history. So it apparently, this was not as unusual as one would have thought. So anyway, that family, the reason I mentioned that is because that family had the advantage, that advantage. Then after the Civil War, they got 40 acres, and like most people, we're still waiting for the mule, but they got 40 acres. It gave them a leg up, and they became business people. And so that family became resourced.
And where was this?
This, it started in Beaufort Bridge, South Carolina, but they had a conflict between the black businesses that they started and the white businesses. And so they were put in jail, and then the family decided to get them out of jail. But unfortunately, the amount of dynamite that was used was a little more than they had expected, and it kind of blew up the jail, so then everybody had to leave. So from what, and Beaufort Bridge no longer exists as a town, but if you look at a map from where Beaufort Bridge was to Charleston, the members of the family in almost every town along, I think it's Route 78, toward Charleston, South Carolina. It's so fascinating.
They blew up the jail to get free their family.
Right, right. I don't think they meant to blow up the whole jail.
They didn't hurt the family when they did it, I hope.
No, no. Apparently they all, you know, made it out. I don't know. I don't know exactly what happened during that conflict. So they just scattered. They scattered and then ended up in Charleston. And so they started businesses again in Charleston. And then became famous for starting an orphanage, which is a now, started in 1891, so it's 120 years, something like that. Nine and four, so a little over 120 years. So the orphanage is a little over 120 years old now.
And that's the Jenkins Institute.
That's the Jenkins Institute, or the Jenkins Orphanage, either one, and if you Google there. And so I grew up in a family in which, one, my mother's family was Geechee and very ingrained in the culture. That culture, my father's family was what they call mulatta, and had more resources. So I was caught between these two families. But clearly for me, my identity is with my mother's family. The reason I mentioned my father's family is because having access to resources to be sent to private schools is, I think, makes a big difference in your projection over your life course. Having had to go to a school like Morehouse College, which is where that family went, where the men in that family went, made a difference also, I think, in my life.
The men in that family, and that family was your...
Were my uncles and
Your mother's side?
My father's.
Your father's side.
My maternal family.
I need to write this down a little bit.
Yeah.
There was your maternal family.
Yeah.
Sorry, I shouldn't have to do this, but
yeah, it's
and
okay.
Your paternal family.
Right.
And your paternal family came from Gambia. Is that
right? Right. At least the oldest member that we know of came from the Gambia.
Okay. And the maternal family was in
probably Angola.
That
side. So they came very early on as
early
rice growers. And
so they came before slavery.
They came before, right around the same time, and they probably came before 1700.
You think they came as free people?
No.
Oh, okay.
I don't
know. So it was early slavery.
Then. Yeah, early slavery, that's right.
Okay, and they were Geechee.
And they spoke Gullah.
Mm-hmm. I think it was that person that I was telling you about that I met, who knew you. he said, well, there's this Geechee Gullah person. I said, oh, you mean Bill Jenkins?
Yes, right.
He said,
that's right.
Okay. And then, and so the person, the Gambia. So the mulattas were your father's, your
that's
paternal.
That's right.
Okay, and they're the ones who went to Morehouse.
Right.
The men in the family went to Morehouse.
Yeah, Morehouse, Spelman, and Howard.
And they had the businesses.
They had the businesses.
Okay.
Still do.
Okay. But your mother's family had the higher status?
No, my mother's family were tradespeople.
Tradespeople.
Yeah. So in the village I grew up in, you know, my grandmother delivered them, my mother taught them, my father buried them. My uncles built their houses and ran the little shop, and they were all tradespeople, but small time.
And they did the orphanage, though, right?
No, sorry, the orphanage. But my father's family, who had a number of, you know, more well-known businesses in the city of Charleston, built the orphanage. They, one of the businesses, they were the primary provider of wood to the city of Charleston.
And was it your great-uncle?
Yes.
Of the orphanage?
Mm-hmm.
And your mother's family created the school, right?
Well, they went to the school. The Quakers
friends.
Created the school.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think I'm back on track.
Yeah. Yeah. So my father's family went to a prep school called Avery.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Immaculate Conception, which is a Catholic school that I was sent to when the Quaker school closed. My mother, who was the first person in her family to go to college, finished the Quaker school early, was deceitful about her age, and started teaching school when she was about 14 or 15. Raised enough money from that to send herself to this prep school, to Avery, where she met my father. And then went to Hunter College.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. But did not finish. She ended up finishing at Benedict College in Columbia, South Carolina.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Hunter College, I'll be darned.
Yeah. But in those days, it was open enrollment.
When would that have been?
Oh, that was late 20s, early 30s, somewhere in there. She's kept trying to go back, but eventually it was just easier to finish at Bennett. My mother-in-law was the first black PhD graduate from Hunter, or Columbia maybe by that time.
Really?
Yes. She also went to Hunter, but later.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Columbia in what?
History. My mother-in-law was a well-known historian.
Hmm.
Yeah. Dr. Margaret Rowley, and they celebrate her as the first black PhD graduate.
Wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember what year that was?
Oh, no, I don't. I could look it up, though.
I guess I really should be interviewing Diane.
Oh, I do know. I think it was 1947, because she graduated the same year that the famous historian at Duke, who died a few years ago, they were graduated the same year. He from Harvard and she from Columbia.
Yeah, I'm blocking on his name, but it'll come back to me.
Right.
Okay. So those that was, and so in the 1940s, when you were born,
mm-hmm.
your parents were both living
in Mount Pleasant, mother's house.
In your mother's house.
Yeah, a bungalow in the Mount Pleasant.
Okay, and were you delivered by her family also, or?
But, of course.
Do you remember who?
My grandmother. Absolutely.
Your maternal grandmother.
My maternal grandmother. She was a black woman, small, dark, a black woman, very strong, very disciplined, very Quakerly. She believed in silence and simplicity, and you know, had all of the Quaker values that one finds today or is propagated today.
So you mentioned that the biracial marriage was on your mother's side.
No, on my father's side. My mother's side is strictly
Geechee.
No intermarrying on my mother's side.
And do you have any other ethnicity represented?
No, just the Scottish guys, as far as I know.
Okay.
Paul Dickerson.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the only. Now, of course, many of my relatives on that side of the family marry Europeans. In fact, more of them marry Europeans than African Americans.
Hmm.
Yep.
okay?
Yeah. So they're different from, and it took me a long time to work through the differences between myself, who identified with my mother's community, but in some ways had to participate on my paternal family because we were the only male Jenkins left. My brother and I were the only two males who had the last name Jenkins. And so, like last month when the city had a celebration, you know, they wanted us to come because we carry, I'm the only one who carries the name.
So, wow.
Yeah.
So, you said something about it was the fact that your father was a mulatto that let you go to the school.
The fact that his family had money is...
It's money. There was a connection between mulatto and money?
Oh, absolutely. In Charleston? Absolutely.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Absolutely.
And that enabled you to go to the...
Catholic school for a while.
Okay.
You know, once I got accepted to college, though, I was allowed to go back to Lang. So that was...
Go back to...
Lang School, my mother's school.
Oh.
Yeah.
So tell me the school. So you started in...
At Lang School.
Which is...
That's the primary school, formerly Quaker.
And that was the former Quaker school.
See, that's right.
So you went to the Lang School,
right.
And then you went to the...
Catholic school.
Immaculate
Conception.
Immaculate Conception. And then you went...
And then when I went back to Lang once I had gotten into college and
once you were accepted.
Once I was accepted, then in the 10th, 11th grade, I guess it was after the 10th grade, I was allowed to go back to Lang School for two reasons. My mother didn't think I was mature enough, for one thing, to be sent to Morehouse. And the second thing is I always wanted to be at Lang. It was where I identified with.
So you were accepted to Morehouse, but you didn't go there right away?
Not right away.
Oh.
Yeah.
So, a year, 2 years?
Two. Yeah.
So you got accepted in the 10th grade.
Going into the 11th, yeah.
Yeah, but still, yeah. I mean, that's pretty early for college acceptance.
Well, not at Morehouse.
Oh.
That's not unusual for Morehouse. Martin Luther King went early. A lot of Morehouse students went early. That was not. Students who showed some whatever were recruited by Morehouse men back in those days. Hmm. And then the family had this connection as well. So the uncle that was being celebrated last month, he went to Morehouse also. So
you went back to Lang for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
and then you set off to Morehouse.
Yeah.
And they decided you didn't know how to talk.
Right. Right, Dr. Mays, yes, son, we don't speak like that here at Morehouse. So I had to take speech from Miss Mitchell for 2 years.
On Saturdays, right?
On Saturdays. No credit.
No credit.
No credit.
Can you remember how you spoke before then?
No, I can't do it. I know, some phrases like, where's your gwine? I could repeat now because when people asked me that question, I went back and listened to my cousins who are still there, and I memorized certain quotes to give an idea of what it was like. Yeah.
So, you weren't interviewed before you went to Morehouse. I mean.
The traditional way is simple. The Morehouse man comes to your house, Sunday dinner, he talks to your parents, and the next thing you know, you're on a train to Morehouse. That was the way it was.
So, apparently, the way you spoke wasn't a problem for getting admitted.
No, I think they just looked at my SAT scores and figured I'd get the rest of it done.
Right.
You
can learn how to talk.
Right.
So, what was it like coming back home speaking differently? I mean, you went off to Morehouse speaking.
Well, first of all, it was 8 years before I ever went back. And that was.
You didn't go back? At all?
No.
Holidays?
No.
Summers?
No.
Why was that?
The only time I can remember wanting to go home was when my grandmother died, and I was on the phone with my mother, and my mother told me, I told her I had an exam, but I could get out of it. My mother said, "What would your grandmother tell you to do?" So I went and took the exam.
But you must have had vacations or holidays or something.
Right. Well,
I mean, I'm just
curious. My mother, what I have mentioned before is my mother is a Trojan wife. You know, a Trojan mother, when the son becomes of age, the mother gives the son a shield and say, "Come back with this shield or on this shield."
You still had your shield, right?
Well, I was not, in her mind, on course. And because I got involved in the civil rights movement, we went to jail, things like that. Going back home for me and facing my mother would have been extraordinarily difficult.
So she held you back for 2 years because she thought you weren't mature enough to go to Morehouse. And then she sent you off, and I guess you need to be mature when that's the operating principle. And so then you got involved in the civil rights movement?
Yeah.
Early on?
Right. Well, when I was a freshman at Morehouse. Well, I got involved even before that, working for Esau Jenkins, no relation, registering to people to vote in Charleston County.
So what year did you go to Morehouse?
In
63. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, that was a busy time.
Yeah, right. And I just worked in the SNCC office and went to jail. I just did what I was told. I was just a gopher, you know. Because you had all these talkative people like Stokely and people like that coming through.
Did you meet Stokely Carmichael?
Oh, of course. All those people. Brown.
H. Rap Brown?
I knew his brother better than I knew H. Rap. He was not somebody I would have talked with, you know. But his brother, Ed Brown, who was older and quieter and more of my style, you know, that's somebody that I knew, yeah.
So your mother didn't like you being in the civil rights movement?
No, because it took me off her track.
Which was?
Law school. My brother was supposed to go to med school. I was supposed to go to law school.
Oh.
So I even joined pre-law
college. Wouldn't that be good training for law school?
Going to jail?
Yeah.
Not in my mother's view. not at all. Not at all. Yeah, no. I had a straight line that I was not supposed to veer from. And I veered. I went to Morehouse. I started pre-law. My advisor from Harvard Law School, because Morehouse had this relationship with Harvard Law at the time, said I should major in math if I was interested in Harvard Law. That's what I did.
Did you like it?
I loved the math. Did not like law.
Well, at least it was good advice, though, in terms of the math.
Yeah, right. I found out the thing that I loved, you know, especially after I got past arithmetic. What people don't understand is, you don't get to mathematics until you pass calculus, you know, and that's when you take abstract algebra and mathematical logic and the stuff that really turns you on, the stuff that, you know, makes you think how to approach a problem, you know, rather than just trying to work through some arithmetic, you know, equation. You're actually thinking about how to solve problems. That's the part of mathematics. We had this German logician who came from Berkeley. Morehouse was being adopted by a lot of the big schools around the country. And he would give these lectures that were just absolutely amazing. And then they would be like 55 minutes long. Not 56 minutes or 54 minutes. You know, Peter Krause. It was just absolutely an amazing...
Was this symbolic logic or...?
Mathematical logic. But, yeah.
Can you give me a few more? I took a symbolic logic course.
Okay.
I was trying to remember.
Well, you start out with set theory, and then you move on into probability theory. And then his first doctor was in philosophy, so he would throw out these philosophical conundrums to you and ask you to apply your mathematical training and logic to solving these conundrums.
Hmm.
So, yeah. Yeah.
I'll have good. To get my logic book, my symbolic logic book, and show it to you and see if it's
okay.
Because, you know, I did really well in math until after calculus.
Until after calculus. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. I kind of, the differential equations, I said, I don't think so. And then I had a roommate who was a math major, and he was doing set theory and these other things.
Right.
And I looked at that and I said, I don't think so.
Yeah. I was so glad to get beyond diff equations until, you know.
I don't know anybody who likes diff
equations. Yeah, right. No, I didn't either. You know, but abstract algebra, where, you know, people tell you for the first time that, you know, a 10-digit, you know, system is not the only system conceivable, and you started figuring out these other kinds of systems, it's absolutely extraordinary, you know? So, yeah. So,
anything else in college that you particularly liked?
I liked a lot of stuff in college. I was all over the place. That I ended up graduating with something like 147 hours because, you know, I took religion. I took a number of religion courses. You know, I'd grown up Catholic. I had been involved in starting the Catholic Youth Organization in the Atlanta University Center, which is the largest Black Catholic youth organization in the country. Now, three of us started that, and I was very interested in religious courses. I took a course from Dr. Blakey, who God is Dead, you know, back in the 60s. Fascinating. That course, I worked harder on that course than any other course I ever took in college. The readings were outrageous, and it was difficult. I did extra theater and stuff like that I liked, sang, stuff like that. But I loved math. Oh, and I minored in psychology, so I taught, I tutored the statistical lab for psychology students, and then I ended up being allowed to give lectures in statistics when I was a senior.
Wow.
Yeah, so, yeah, Morehouse gave you the opportunity to test your waters, you know. So that was extraordinary. So I'm from 2 weeks after graduating from Morehouse, I was in biometry at Emory.
So just before we get there, what did you do in your summers? Was that all for the civil rights movement?
Work and take courses.
Work and take courses all summer as well as...
12 months out of the year I was in school.
Wow.
Yeah. Because I had to finish in 4 years. My mother, there was no option about not finishing in 4 years.
You can in principle, you can finish in 4 years without doing summer courses, can't you?
But I wanted to take these other courses.
So you voluntarily...
Yeah, so I was taking 18 to 21 hours every semester, plus summer school.
Good heavens.
Yeah, I liked school.
And what were you working, but you were working also?
I was working at a clothing store called Walters, and I also tailored robes for preachers, you know, because they like fancy
you
robes.
Did tailoring?
Well, I took tailoring at Lang, when I went to Lang. At that time, particularly Black Quaker schools, you had to... take a trade as well as academic training.
So tell me about tailoring. What you learned? I don't know if
I learned how to make a suit, although I couldn't make one now.
You learned how to make a suit?
Yeah, right. All the measurements and designing on the paper and then cutting and yeah.
Did you ever make a suit? Did you ever make one?
I made one suit, which I don't know that anybody would want to wear, but, you know, I finished it.
That's impressive.
Right, Mr. Frazier.
I can't imagine.
Yeah. Everybody had to take a trade as well as the academic, for those of us in the academic track, yeah, you had to also take a trade.
When I was in high school, we had shop.
Oh, yeah. Some students did that too. Right.
And there was sewing.
Right.
I don't think there was tailoring.
Well, yeah, the females took what they called sewing, but the men took tailoring. And there was a woman who taught sewing, and then Mr. Fraser taught tailoring. Because making a man's suit is, you have these arithmetic relationships that you have to fulfill as you design the suit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so
they designed it as well as making it.
Under Mr. Fraser's direction.
Yeah, well, of course.
Right.
That's reasonable.
Yeah.
I mean, I took shop. I think I took a couple of them, but I didn't learn anything serious.
Yeah.
That I could be able to do.
Yeah, the only thing I think you were able to figure out is whether you wanted a French cuff or a straight cuff, or how wide your label was.
Yes.
So beyond that, Mr. Fraser was telling you what to do.
Okay, basically. Well, that's good. I'm sure of a good result.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so 2 weeks after you graduated from Morehouse,
mm-hmm.
you were in biometry at Emory.
Mm-hmm.
And how did that happen?
The head of the psychology department who took an interest in me, and Dr. Siegel. And arranged for me to go to Emory and arranged for me to get into the Public Health Service Commission Corps, because after graduating, the draft board at Mount Pleasant wanted to draft me in the Army.
Oh, this would have been 67.
67, yeah.
Mm.
You're right. So, and I can remember I was sitting in the room with this other guy who was in the 6th or 7th year at Clemson University. And they gave him an exemption, and I thought, well, you know, I just graduated mathematics with honors, and I'm in Emory and biometry, I'm going to get a deferment. No.
Really?
Yeah, 1A. So, yeah. My experience with Emory was not, it was my first experience of discrimination, you know, because up until then, I was always in a all-black environment, it was the first time I ran into a teacher who was extraordinarily biased towards African Americans, and my roommate and I set up this little test on an exam. Yvonne, I can't remember what his last name, he was French-Canadian, and he was something like 14 or 15.
years old?
Yeah, he was a genius from Canada, French-Canadian. And we decided to set up this little thing. So there was this exam, and Yvonne was by far the smartest kid in the program. So, you know, we decided to help this guy in the class, white guy, for some of the answers and made sure that a couple of his answers weren't correct. Then,
so this was a take-home or something?
It was a take-home. Then we gave, then he turned in his homework and I turned in my homework, and he made sure that my homework had at least one more correct answer than the other kid. And of course, the other kid got a higher grade than I did. So we went to the head of the program, Malcolm Turner, and wanted to protest it, and he told us that we should be quiet. And so I left.
Did he give you a reason?
The same sort of a Jackie Robinson thing. You know, you're the first one here, so, you know, you shouldn't.
Were you the first African-American?
In the biometry program.
At Emory?
Well, there were 3 other black students reportedly on the campus that year. I never saw them. I went to Dooley's, you know, looking for the other black students that were supposed to have been there, but I never saw them. I'm not Jackie Robinson. I'm not, you know.
So you were in the Commission Corps at this time also, though.
Right. So what happened was, between my draft board in 1A and the experience at Emory, I decided I better go into the Public Health Service Commission Corps in order to avoid the draft.
But so did you have a 2S originally?
No, I was 1A.
So you had to get your Commission Corps. Oh, well, I guess what I'm wondering is, if you weren't in the Commission Corps when you went to Emory,
yeah,
what kept you in the commission? What kept you out of the draft then, or they just hadn't called you enough?
Well, I did delay getting drafted by a few weeks. I flunked the mathematics part.
You flunked the mathematics part?
Yes.
Of the qualifying test of the Army?
Yes. And one of the great things about getting the right answers is you also know what the wrong ones are. So, and then the Army recruiter guy got upset about that when he looked back and found that I was a math major and so on.
So, this is interesting. So you got called up for your physical after college. You got called up for your physical?
Yeah, the first thing they did was to give the test before they did all the physical stuff for some reason. I don't know back then.
I can't remember. I went through it too, but
yeah.
I can't remember. So the first thing they call you when you take the test.
Right.
And then you flunk the math.
Right, I flunked the math.
So then they waited a while
and right.
tried to figure out what the world's going
right,
on.
Right, right. Well, no, I don't know how he figured it out. I don't know what happened. I don't know how he could have figured that out, but he did.
So you were off at Emory. What were they going to do? So because you had failed, they weren't going to draft you?
They weren't going to draft me until the recruiter figured out.
But I mean, they weren't just because your math was...
Yeah.
So bad?
Oh, I was very bad.
I didn't know that there was a math qualification.
I wouldn't have known by my score on the test. I wouldn't have been able to tell my left from my right. You know. So yeah.
So it's because I didn't realize that was an opportunity.
Yeah. Well, when you're desperate, you think of all kinds.
I was desperate.
Yeah.
I didn't think as creatively.
Yeah.
So you were at Emory on borrowed time, and then the recruiter realizes that something's the matter?
Well, what happened was, by that time I had left Emory, and I knew I had to do something. So once I was 1A, I started the process of getting into the Public Health Service Commission Corps.
And how did this psychology professor help you to do that?
He connected me with a recruiter from the National Center for Health Statistics. And it turned out for me, very, very lucky, this is fluke thing, that the Public Health Service Commission Corps was desperate for biostatisticians at the time. And I was one of the few students in the country who had not only taken statistics courses undergrad, but then I had also taken two courses at the graduate level at Emory. So...
That was your first semester. What semester did you have this exam issue that you left Emory? So you'd already finished the first semester?
I finished the first part of the summer course. Yeah, it was a summer course.
The biometry one.
That's right.
I see, okay.
So after I finished the first part and then this exchange, I went to NCHS, who first hired me as a civilian, but then were working very hard to get me my commission.
Was this in Hyattsville then?
This was eventually, was originally downtown Washington and HEW South and North, right on at 330 Independence Avenue.
Oh, okay. So yeah. That's where you went for the... To persuade them to hire you?
Exactly.
And that's where you started working?
Yeah. Well, they agreed to hire me just based on my record, but they hired me as a civilian until they could work through the Commission Corps.
And did they know that you were African-American?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that wasn't an issue then?
No. No. In fact, there were three African-Americans they recruited from Morehouse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They were all from Morehouse.
So, okay, so you've left Emory and you're now at NCHS.
You're right.
And you're not in the Commission Corps yet, but you will be soon.
Hopefully, right.
So let me go back to the story then.
So I got a letter that says I was supposed to report to Fort Dix. By that time, you know, I was a resident in Washington. I was supposed to report Dix for physical and induction. Because the guy, you know.
Oh, the pre-induction physical.
Yeah,
that's the real one.
He was pissed.
Yeah.
So anyway, but somehow, and I think it was the director of NCHS, Ted Woolsey, who made his contacts, got President Johnson to sign our commission papers.
He got President Johnson to sign your papers?
Lyndon Johnson, yeah.
So he must have been pretty influential.
Well, if you walk on Yale's campus, I think there are three Woolsey Halls.
Oh. Yeah, but I thought it was Bush who went to Yale. I thought Johnson, Johnson didn't go to Yale, did he?
No. But I'm just saying, the Woolsey family were connected.
So you got in the Commission Corps, but you still stayed working at NCHS.
So I got in the Commission Corps and stayed at NCHS. And eventually, after my two-year training in biostatistics at Emory, I mean at NCHS, Ted Woolsey, asked me to work directly for him as his assistant.
And before that, though, you had your physical to get into the Commission Corps?
Yeah, I did that.
Tell me about?
Well, yeah, that was interesting.
My was that 67?
My first attempt to get the physical for the Commission Corps was still in Atlanta.
Yeah.
But the woman who was at the desk told me I was definitely at the wrong place.
Now, just to understand, so this was through NCHS, Commission Corps?
Right.
So you were at NCHS, they said, okay, your papers have been signed.
Right.
Go down to Atlanta to take the physical.
You had to walk up the hill to take the physical. Remember, I was still in Emory at the time.
Oh, okay.
Right.
So you went to CDC
right.
to take the physical,
right.
and the lady at the desk
said,
said no. And you said, but look, I've got papers.
That's right.
And she said,
at which time the guard comes up with his hand on the gun and said, you know, you're in the wrong place, you need to leave. So I left. And NCHS flew me up to Washington.
For your physical?
Yeah. So I took it. I took my physical in the HEW South building.
Well, what did they say when you said to them that CDC wasn't going to let you take the physical there? What did the NCHS people say? I mean, you told them, didn't you?
Yeah. They didn't say anything. They just said, come to Washington, we'll give you the physical. That's all. I don't think that they were particularly surprised that it happened. Ted Woolsey was a interesting guy. He was an interesting guy. He was he had strong beliefs about data, and he had strong beliefs about right, good, and right, and just, and things like that. His degree was actually in astrology.
Astronomy. That would have been pretty.
That's right. Astronomy, right? Yeah.
So they flew you up there, and you had your physical in Washington, and you passed it, and then you went back to...
No, I stayed.
You just stayed there.
I never went back.
Mm-hmm. So now you're at NCHS, and you spent 2 years in training?
Yeah.
And then you're working for Woolsey?
Yeah.
And what were you doing for him?
I was appointed a Deputy Equal Employment Opportunity Officer for the Public Health Service.
For all of PHS?
Well, PHS. No. It was HRSA at the time. That's what it was called. And that was, the Public Health Service was divided into pieces. And HRSA was, so there was a subsection under PHS called HRSA, Health Services and Mental Health Administration. And so it was HRSA, but Public Health Service too, because there weren't that many EEO offices in the Public Health Service generally. But the Public Health Service at that time included like the Indian Health Service, which was mainly out in the West and so on.
But you were in NCHS, right?
I was at NCHS, which at that particular time was a part of HRSA, and then became a part of CDC almost immediately.
It was part of HRSA. I didn't know
that. Well, HRSA was dissolved.
So it's not the HRSA that we have now?
No.
I guess I don't know enough of the bureaucracy from those days.
Yeah.
So you were in NCHS, which is part of HRSA. Woolsey was director of
NCHS.
NCHS, mm-hmm. But he arranged for you to be EEOO for HRSA.
No, for NCHS.
NCHS, okay.
And there were several EEO offices who were created at that time for the public. Well, I guess it was the Public Health Service. I just realized that. Because we were all together. Frank Miller, who was CDC, was also on the team with me. I guess you're right. I don't know why I didn't think that.
I'm just thinking I'm trying to beat you.
Right. So we were all on the team together.
In public health service.
In the public health service. EOO. That's right. We were public health service officers. And then, for some reason, I also was some kind of special assistant for upward mobility. I also became a special assistant in the secretary's office on upward mobility.
Secretary
of HEW.
Oh, wow.
And then I was made a special assistant for whatever problems HEW had at the time.
Was this Joseph Califano who was the secretary?
Yeah, Crazy Joe.
I had not heard him call back before.
Yeah, right. So the one assignment I got several assignments, some of which, you know, you don't talk about, but one assignment that changed my mind about staying in the Commission Corps was I was assigned to get communities to take control over old public health service hospitals that we were closing down. And my job was basically to sell to the Black community that they could have their own hospital, basically. Which on the surface sounded like a good thing. Except after doing that for maybe a year, I realized these communities couldn't handle these old hospitals like that. These places were, you know, in disrepair and complex to manage and so on. And while, you know, the government could manage them, some community in Galveston or Baltimore, where I was assigned, those communities couldn't really handle. And that they were so grateful, and they thought I was a hero to bring them this hospital. On the one hand, I knew it was really a disaster.
How did you deal with it?
I decided I was going to leave the public health service.
The Commission Corps.
By this time now, I'm six, seven years in. Yeah.
So I didn't know you could leave it. Is it that easy to leave?
Well, no, it's not that easy to leave. Again, Ted Woolsey, I wanted to resign, and he said, well, why don't you go to Georgetown, get a master's degree so you can finish up, and let's see what happens in 2 years when you get ready to come back. And so I went to Georgetown and bought statistics. And by the time the 2 years was up at Georgetown, Ted Woolsey had retired. I'm not sure what happened. And the new director, should I say who the new director was?
Sure, I mean, it's public.
Okay,
right?
Yeah, right. Ed Sontag.
Oh, Ed Sontag, yeah, I know him.
Yeah, he wanted to force me to come back to NCHS. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to come back to NCHS. I wanted to go to Atlanta. So we had a, what do you call it, frank and open discussion. And I resigned the Commission Corps
at that point.
Which he was happy to accept my resignation. So, but by that time I had finished Georgetown and I was being recruited to UNC. So, you know, Robert Huntley was chair of community medicine. That was the department the virus I was in.
At Georgetown.
Mm-hmm. Right. And some of us, two of us had done well in the community medicine course. And so he wanted to know if we were interested in starting the medical school on probation. We would have to be on probation for a year to see if we could do well in medical school. But we didn't have to take the MCAT. So I thought, I never knew that was even possible. But apparently you can do it on probation.
It's Georgetown Medical School?
Yeah. But his wife was Joan Canone, And he had mentioned me, I guess, I don't know. So she was so wonderful, you know, she was just so warm. And then I said, well, North Carolina, I don't know.
Where did you meet her? Did you meet her?
I didn't meet her until I actually came here for the visit.
How did you know she was so warm and everything? I mean,
over the phone.
Oh, so she called you?
Was her husband actually from the office? I don't know which. When the first call.
So she reached out to you.
She
heard
out
about
to
her
me.
From Robert. And
yeah.
And she reached out to you.
Yeah.
And persuaded you to come to Chapel Hill?
To at least look at Chapel Hill. Because I was interested in, you know, in that H stamp, like most people.
In the?
Harvard.
Harvard. Oh.
So I went to Boston and, you know, talked to a couple of people. Came to UNC. And like in Boston, it was like rain and cold, and the people were just cold, you know. And then I came to Chapel Hill, and it was like 78 degrees. It was warm, sunshine, you know. And
people
Castle,
were smiling.
Yeah, right. And Castle was fascinating, even though he smoked a pipe, which I thought was strange. But, you know, he was a fascinating guy, and he was talking about how, you know, we needed more quantitative people in epidemiology to work through some of the more complex variables and blah, blah, blah. And to spend your interest in issues of diversity and stuff like that. And then apparently he was telling the same thing to Sherman James at the time, and how important social psychology was.
But they were both important.
That's true, but I just find it interesting that he basically told the two of us the same thing, and we ended up.
Well, yeah.
You're right.
He's consistent.
Specific to me, he was very consistent.
Well, and tailor your approach.
Right, yeah. So, in spite of one small incident, I was, I wanted to come to Chapel Hill. And the small incident,
I can try to edit it out if you decide
okay,
you don't want to take it.
So I'm there. I'm from, you know, I had government stuff still. So I had my papers in a mail envelope. You know, the holy government envelopes. Like mail was handed back in those days, brown envelopes with holes in it.
Oh, yeah, inter-office.
Inter-office.
These were your papers for...
So for my application and his, you know, CV and all that.
To UNC.
To UNC.
Uh-huh.
And this professor came through and repeatedly told me to put the mail down. And I was waiting for Castle. He thought I was the dumbest person I had ever met. He had to tell me three times to just leave the mail. So,
did you tell him that you were waiting to see John Castle?
No, never did. And in fact, it was a long time before I would even talk to him because I was felt sort of, you know, whatever. He turned out to be not to be a bad guy.
Certainly
and he
not.
Was right, and he was, a very important mentor to Sherman James. So clearly, it was just miscommunication. But I have to admit, that first year, I wouldn't even talk to him.
You know, I remember being in that American College of Epidemiology Board of Directors meeting
mm-hmm.
in some hotel when you came in after the meeting had started.
Right.
Your suitcase.
Right.
And it was the president of the college said, you put it over there.
Right, exactly. Yeah, back in those days, you know.
That was not so far many days ago. It was what, in the 80s, I guess,
yeah,
probably.
Right.
Oh, no, I was on the board. It would have been in the 90s.
Yeah, that's right. It should have been 92 or 93,
something
I think.
Like
that.
Yeah. Well, actually, later than that, because I don't think I got on the board for a few years.
Mm.
Anyway, so mid-90s, mm-hmm. something like that.
Right.
So it happens.
It happens. I don't even think about it anymore. I mean, you know, it's what... Racism is a pervasive thing, and you know many African Americans want to believe that we are not racist. You know that it's only European Americans who are racist. All of us, you know, have these judgment based on how somebody look or how they're dressed or how they talk. You know, it is the nature of the way in which we think. You know, if we didn't think like that, you know, we would have died off a long time ago.
Right. How else would one think?
Exactly.
Because although it's true with race, it's racism, but it's also done with class, with pronunciation, accents.
Right.
Oh, this person must be from there, and that whatever it is, or they didn't have this education, or things like that. So,
But making judgments, you know, from individual experience to the general, why am I blanking on that? This is logic.
But induction. Anyway, induction.
Yeah, induction. And it's the way humans, it's the way our brains work. So why people get so freaked out about it, I'm not sure. It is something all of us should be aware of so that we minimize the negative consequences of that way in which we think. But it is a part of the way we think. You know?
Well, and you know, when a doctor is, when you go to see a doctor and he's trying to evaluate your symptoms and what it is, he thinks in terms of probability.
Right, exactly.
So what's this most likely to
exactly,
be?
Exactly, exactly.
So,
Right. And we don't think, like, for example, when that Ebola case happened in Houston, you know, people got upset with her because when he came into the clinic, she didn't think zebras. Most people don't think zebras when you go in. You think horses, you know?
Right. So, of course, the other side of that, I mean, just so it doesn't sound as if I'm trying to whitewash everything, it's not a case that the majority of people with African-American or lower education or whatever would be in a category that they're being placed in automatically. You know, like, the most classic one is crime.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, I'm worried about crime, but that would imply that most of the people, I mean, it's not like of the symptoms, if this is the symptom, the most likely diagnosis would be this and this. It's not necessarily the most likely diagnosis.
Right, that's right.
So,
So
it was a miscommunication.
Yeah.
But it wasn't enough to turn you away from Chapel Hill.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Now,
although I kept, you know, sometimes I would get a little paranoid because everybody was nice to me. I mean, everybody was nice to me. And I was thinking, wait, what is this place? You know, in fact, when I finally finished Chapel Hill, I said, I have got to get out of this place. It is too nice. Everybody is nice. The weather is nice. This is ridiculous. You know, there's a world out there, you know.
Did it ever occur to you that because the weather is nice, maybe it makes it easier for people to be nice?
Maybe, that's true.
Now, let's get the years down. So which year was this that you had this interview with John Castle? And
that would have been 1970. The end of 1973, I guess.
The end of 73.
Right.
And then so you started here in fall of 73? Or
fall of 74.
Fall of 74.
Yeah.
Now, had you been in MCH before that? Or
MCH? No, I was never in MCH. My wife.
Your wife was in MCH.
Yeah.
And when did she
was recruited too, also.
At the same time as you.
Right.
So
because once I came for the interview, she came with me. She met Arden Miller, and he just fell in love with her.
So when did you get married?
69.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Soon as she finished Spelman. You know, at Morehouse, you had to marry a Spelman woman. That was required. It came with a degree.
Okay.
You know, and she was one of these extraordinary people, you know, smart, cute, very, you know, attractive in a style way. She was a musician, a harpist, you know, composed. She just, you know, incredible writer. She was just one of these super people, and Arden Miller just fell in love with her.
So, did she become a doctoral student?
She came actually on faculty. She had an MSW from Howard.
Ah.
And she came on as faculty in the practice or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that was in 74.
That was in 74.
So.
But she was also working on a doctorate in the department at the same time.
In MCH?
In MCH.
Oh, I see. Okay. So, 74, you landed here as a doctoral student in epidemiology, and you took Epi 160, presumably?
Mm-hmm. 161.
161, right. Oh, yeah, I think we talked about this.
Yeah.
But that would have been John Castle giving the lectures in the auditorium, right?
He gave a couple of lectures, but it was mainly Imran.
Because in 72, fall 72, when my wife took EPI 161, it was the lectures in the auditorium with John Castle, and then the lab and an additional lecture with Abdul Imran.
Right.
So
right.
was that 74?
Right.
And Abdul Imran was your advisor?
Right. And my mentor, and my funder.
And your funder.
And my funder.
You have a CPC
traineeship? Yes, absolutely. Right. That, you know, he can't, the, who did, oh, that's right. They sent me to Imran and he put three pieces of paper in front of me and said, so I have three fellowships, which one do you want? You know, I said, well, which one pays the most money? He says CPC.
So was it a Noyes Foundation fellowship? Do you remember?
No, I don't remember.
Okay. Did it come with a 10-hour-a-week service requirement?
It was a 10-hour-a-week service requirement because I became his TA. At that time, at Emory. Not Barbara Halker, but...
Carol Hogue?
Carol Hogue. Carol Hogue had been his teaching assistant.
Ah.
So Carol Hogue interviewed me.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, we had that very first
day. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's too bad.
She asked me what made me think I was qualified for the position, and I suggested I was more qualified than she was when she got it. I was being a smart ass.
I think that's fair to say.
I don't think she appreciated. She did not appreciate that.
It's probably not the answer she was expecting.
No. I don't know. I don't. When I walked into the room, I don't know why. I just felt. Sometimes I have these days when I just want to mess with people. I don't know. And she just looked like somebody I could mess with, so I did it. So whatever.
But anyway, you were hired.
Yes. Yeah, perhaps over her objection, I don't know. But
she was moving on, I guess.
Yeah, she was moving on. You know, so...
So that was fall 74.
Right.
And you started out as a...
The teaching assistant.
But in what? In
EPI. EPI.
But you were just taking the course.
Yeah, but I had a master's in biostatistics, and I had EPI at Georgetown.
Oh, so you did, for your master's, you'd already taken...
I'd already taken EPI. You know,
okay.
So McMahon and Pugh, in fact, that was a text.
I remember that one.
Right. Yeah, so I'd already taken the course. I was just taking it because UNC wanted me to have on my record that I took the course at UNC.
Right.
But obviously, you know, and I was in love with EPI at that time. Uh-huh. I mean, I fell in love with EPI at Georgetown, so, you know, I knew McMahon and Pugh. You know,
so what was it like being a student? How were your student years?
I had a good time. The teaching was great. The experiences that Imran gave me were great. And he didn't just teach me epidemiology, but he taught me how to handle myself, you know, so I didn't get people like Carol Hope pissed off anymore off the bat, you know, so yeah, it was great, I think, and then early on in the next year, I became head of the Black Students Group.
Black Students Caucus,
and we created a course called the Survival Course. Jim Morrell and I.
Mm-hmm.
So because Black students who were coming to the school were not doing well in epidemiology or biostatistics, so our course in the evenings at 6 were to teach Black students specifically how to survive biostat and epi. So for those years we ran that course, I think it was 3 years, no African American students got less than a B in both of those courses. You know. And then other people heard about the course. So other students, primarily ethnic students like Glumby and other students started coming to the course. Yeah.
So were there a lot of black students then?
No, not a lot. As I remember, my first year, my wife was not, because she was also at an office, you know, and discussions with Arden about stuff. I don't think people saw her as a student, even though she was a student.
Mm-hmm, right.
So the one student I remember was Janet Miles, or Mills, Janet Miles, I think was her name, who was in Hawaii now.
In EPI?
Must have been Health Education.
Were there other EPI students, African-American EPI students?
Oh, no. Not that first year. Well, yeah, no, not then. Not then. It was just me. A year or two later, Jerome came.
Yeah, it was later, because I was here when he came.
Right, and also Leo Hendricks.
I think I was here when he came.
Yeah, right.
So when I came in 72, in fall of 72, mm-hmm. in the health ed department, mm-hmm. I think half of the class was African-American that year.
Right, there were, yeah.
It was 20 students or something like that, and
right.
half were African-American.
Yes.
It was the only semester, I mean, I don't know that it was that way before, I don't think so.
I don't know, it was
and
not.
It wasn't that way afterwards.
No. Mm-mm.
And I don't know if that was because of Lou Nydorf being the head of admissions.
I'm sure.
Or something, but it was, that's where I met Ethel Jean.
Yeah.
And Frankie.
Because you had also students in health administration that year.
Right.
Reed Jean, Brayboy, and all them, yeah.
And Curtis Jackson.
And Curtis Jackson, right there. That's right.
So also in health ed, I mean, so health ed and Haddam.
Yeah.
But
not
biostat. Not biostat. Mm-hmm. And MCH?
Well, Cynthia.
But she was...
I think there was another student, but who I did not know.
Just one other.
Yeah.
Now, David Kleinbaum taught some kind of a summer course.
Right.
Was that before that or after that? Do you have any recollection?
Well, I know David... I don't remember exactly. Dave, when I came in 74, David wanted to write a book about biostat.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked me if I was interested in working with him, and I said no, because I felt that I was overextended.
Mm-hmm.
Big mistake.
Possibly.
Yeah, because David was a cool guy.
David was a very cool guy.
Yeah, right, right. I liked
his books have done very well.
That's right, absolutely. That's right.
And you could have done the short courses.
That's right. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So, in the EPI faculty, anybody stand out in your mind? Any courses particularly that you took? Who were the one
course that, you know, of course I loved just the EPI stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know. But the one course that stuck in my mind was Ralph Patrick's at the Epidemiology of Program Acceptance. And I didn't want to take the course, but Amran said, you got to, you know, take this course. So I took the course. And he was an anthropologist.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember sitting in the course thing, and then he was this cool white boy with white long hair, you know, and tall, thin, and, you know, sort of laid back, and I was thinking, oh God, this is going to be a boring course. And then, you know, he starts talking, you know, and I'm thinking, oh, just let me out of here. And then after a while, I'm thinking, wait a minute, say that again. You know, he starts talking about how people accepted the salt vaccine and the cultural and demographic issues around. And I'm thinking, whoa, wait a minute. So that was an interesting course. It made me rethink, you know, ideologic factors in epidemiology.
Talk about the Ponape Islands?
Yes, that's right. You know, I talked about Margaret Mead's work, you know, and just fascinating. And then Ed Wagner's course, I'm a biostatistician. I'm not interested in body parts. Why are you talking to me? You know what I mean? And then
which course of this was his?
This was something like the physiology or something like that.
Okay, because there was a biomedical course that he taught for a few years, I
think. That's it. Right.
He didn't teach it when, I don't think it was
Oh, okay.
I don't think so.
Okay. And so, but it wasn't until we talked about the paper that I had to write for this course. And I started thinking about the circulatory system and how it controls blood pressure. And then I remembered the physics I took at Morehouse, and there was one part of the physics course that I really got interested in. It was cybernetics. You know, the way in which systems control themselves and how the body, you know, how cybernetics systems could be applied to the control of blood pressure. And he got me excited about, you know, that. Like he said, I don't know what the hell you're talking about, but it certainly sounds interesting. You know, I took Cook's course.
Gary Cook.
Categorical data analysis. And I went to the class, and there were like 50 students and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, so I went through studying and blah, blah, blah. And it was work, you know. And then I go and take the midterm, and there were four people in the room. All those other people were auditing. Because the reputation of this course was not good in terms of being able to pass. Freaked me out. Yeah, so those are the kinds of experiences. Yeah, those are the kinds of experiences I had. You know, it was cool.
Any other? Did you take the cardiovascular disease course?
Of course, yeah.
And that was being taught by Altair Roller?
Yeah.
And Gerardo at the time, or not?
Yeah.
And cancer epi?
Yeah. Who taught
Barbara
cancer?
Hawker, was she?
Yeah, right. Yeah, then her husband gave that lecture. Ooh, scary guy.
Jerry.
Yeah.
Scary, gave lecture in cancer epidemiology?
Yeah. He was an interesting guy. He would get off on these tangents. And he caused a crisis for the black students at the school, you know.
No.
Yeah.
I didn't know.
Oh, okay. So the student from some town near here, north of Durham, I can't remember her name, black students.
From Roxborough?
From Roxborough. She was from Roxborough. She, quiet. No, I was trying to remember her name. But anyway, Ethel something, I thought. But I don't know. Anyway, so he was giving this lecture, and he started rambling about the difference between black women and white women's vaginas. And I'm thinking, and she is sitting there. And he didn't notice, apparently, or whatever. When he sees her, he gets, you know, he realizes that he said something inappropriate. So he talks to her about not mentioning this little incident that, you know, was just a misunderstanding.
So was it a joke that he was making?
I think it was some kind of joke or statement. I wasn't there on that one.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I know he'd come close to saying inappropriate stuff before, so, you know, I wasn't surprised. And she had no intentions of saying anything. But what happened was that when the discussion apparently between him and Castle, or Barbara and Castle, or somebody, Castle wanted to talk to me about, you know, not allowing this to grow out of proportion. And I said, oh, I don't think it'll grow out of proportion. Could you explain it again to me? Because nobody had told me shit. He was the first one who told me. When I found out, you know, we started arranging protests, you know, Bernie Greenberg, you know how Bernie was. Bernie was like this, you know, hand, that, mother hand that kept us in line, you know, and, you know, just wonderful person. But he liked us to be nice to each other and, yeah, you know, and so on. And I was pissed. So I gave him a headache. I'm sure I gave him a headache. But it finally got resolved, or we got tired, I don't know which, you know.
So when I was a student in 72 in health ed, the black students got unhappy with John Castle. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you heard about that. I wasn't as involved or connected in those days, mm-hmm. but I think it had something to do with the fact that he would often use African Americans in examples. I mean, blacks and whites.
Yeah.
Showing health disparities.
Right.
And I think he was doing it because he thought it was important.
That's right, he did. Absolutely, he did.
But the African-American students, or at least a number right. of them, said, you know, they're always putting us in a bad light.
That's right, right, right.
And that was a real kind of catch-22, it seems.
Right, exactly, exactly.
Did you, could you give any more, I mean, you weren't there in 72.
No, I think his he talked to me about it when I interviewed. He talked about the fact that, you know, I had my work had indicated a interest in this area about disparities and so on, and that, you know, he thought that this is the kind of work we really needed to do more work in and so on, that we needed to talk about it and bring it up and discuss it, you know. And I could see many black, the two things that conservative black students tend to be sensitive about. It is about discussions about the disparities, because they felt like they're being put down. And then they, many of them, want to be seen as intelligent. This is one of the things that I Armand was, you know, fascinating, you know, because what he would say is, You don't have to look intelligent, you just have to be intelligent. And then sometimes you let people think what they want to think when it's to your advantage. A lesson I never forgot after that, because it came in handy at CDC. You know, what you want, and I had thought about it fleetingly before, but not putting it into words at Georgetown. When I went to Georgetown, I think there were 7 of us in the course. There were 2 blacks, 3 whites whose uncle or relatives were famous biostatisticians. Earl Bryant's son, several biostatisticians whose relatives were famous biostatisticians. And so they saw themselves as smart, you know, and we were not so smart. Jackie Kennedy and I were not so smart. And what that experience taught me was, it's not where you start out, it's where you end up. Because at the midterm, they're ahead of us. You know, at the pre-final, we were neck and neck. But the final, that's what counts, you know? So, you know, it's, it was an important lesson for me, not to feel like I've got to project that I'm smart, and in fact, let people think you're stupid. It's okay.
You know? I've always relied on trying to look smart.
Yeah.
I remember one incident when I was at it was before I enrolled in the school. I went to a summer course out at University of Indiana, the Kinsey Institute, a summer course in human sexuality.
That's right.
And we had lectures in the morning. I think Paul Gephardt was giving a lecture or something. And then, you know, people could ask questions and make statements and stuff. And so we had the session, and I, of course, stood up and said something and whatever. Afterwards, this woman comes to me and she said, "How could you say that?"
Yeah.
And I said, "Oh, I don't know, I was just saying it." She said, "But you looked so sure." And I realized that apparently I looked more authoritative than I felt.
Yeah, right, yeah, yeah.
But did John Castle say anything to you about the reaction or response he was getting, complaints he was getting from students?
No, he never mentioned it to me.
Because I didn't really understand it fully, but I did I mean, I think it was partly about the impression that was being given. It's kind of like the deficit model.
These people are less healthy and so on. Right.
My
impression is that he was sure, based on the South African experience, that this was an important thing to talk about. And I don't think he would have, it would have dissuaded him from talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, he never mentioned it to me. So, and I would have come up, and I would have agreed with him.
Mm-hmm. So 74 to 5, you were a student here, 75 to 6, and what then happened? And how did you pick your dissertation topic, and what was your dissertation topic?
Oh, well, my original dissertation topic was the relationship between nutrition and infectious disease in Sahel, Africa.
In where?
Sahel.
Sahel, Africa. Uh-huh.
Yeah, the Sahel region, Eastern Africa. But nobody was interested in the topic. And again, Amran. So, what do you want to do? Finish here or do this dissertation? Yeah, so I said, oh, well, that's clear now that you put it that way. You know what I mean? He had this way of not exactly telling you what to do, but asking you these, giving you these dichotomies that makes it real clear about what the real answer is. So eventually I knew that I wanted Amran as chair, because at that point, you know, he had a lot of money, he had his own house back there, he was, you know, a strong chair. And I put 7 people on my committee.
Wow, that was reckless.
Yeah, but it turned out to be a good idea. Because I had Richard Udry on my committee.
Oh.
And halfway through my analysis, it was clear that he was not going to be supportive of me. So I went to his office and wondered if he was still interested in staying on my committee, and that I would be fine if he decided not to stay. So we got rid of the only negative person on my committee. And it was what I did was create this data set of infant mortality rates and demographic variables for each county in the United States. You're trying to use small area data analysis, and one of the very first attempts in the county lab at later to try to analyze relationships and so on.
So what you were looking at, what variables?
I was looking at regional demographic and whatever social variables that I could put into the model.
So it was like an ecological analysis?
Yes, exactly. That's what it was, an ecological analysis. And then there was an ecological, a mathematical issue that arose in the analysis. There was something called the ecological fallacy. And what I ended up also doing was testing the parameters when the ecological analysis gave a right answer and when it gave a wrong answer.
Hmm.
And so that was the methodological part of it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what years were those that you...
That must have been, by that time, it was like 66 or 67. I'm 76 or 77.
And so did you... But you didn't finish your dissertation then, did you?
I don't know what I did, Vic. I woke up one Saturday morning. I had 3 or 4 chapters done. I woke up one Saturday morning and says, this place is too much. This is too strange. I want to get back to Atlanta.
Because everybody would be so nice to you.
Yeah, right, exactly. And I want to get out of here. So I just packed
up. When was that? That was...
That was 77, I think it was.
Spring of 77?
No, it must have been later.
Fall?
Yeah.
Because I was here, I came in fall 77.
Okay.
And I don't remember, I mean, I met you, but I don't remember whether I met you. Maybe yeah. I did meet you, though, I don't know.
Yeah, I would, yeah. I'd seen you.
You would have been in the student room probably working.
That's right, exactly.
But then you disappeared.
That's exactly right. I just woke up one Saturday morning.
I couldn't find you anymore. So
right. I just, I don't know why I did that.
So you went down to Atlanta?
I just drove to Atlanta.
Did you withdraw formally?
I called Amran after a couple of weeks. I called and told him. He freaked out too.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So when you got to Atlanta, what'd you do?
I taught school. For a little while, I worked
like
on the back
school?
Of a truck.
High school or something?
Mm-hmm, Washington High School. Worked on the back of a truck. anything I could find, basically. And then I applied for a job for the state of Georgia. The State Health Planning and Development Commission, or something like that. First time I ever applied for a job in my life, just out of the blue, applied for a job. And I went in there, the person in the personnel office called somebody and she said, wait here. And then 40 minutes later, they said, I think you have a job. Why don't you go out to this office for talk to Pat Leet, who was the director. And gave me a job for 2 years, a contract for 2 years. So that was it. There are still very few people with the training, Biostat, Epi.
But even without interviewing you?
She didn't really offer me the job until I went out to the office part.
Oh, then you went and had the interview.
You're right.
Far out.
But it was very quick. She.
So you were a student here. One morning you decided to leave. You went down to Atlanta. You taught school. You got a job teaching school?
Yeah, I was...
You must have applied for that.
No. Mm-mm. I was... Why was I at this... I was at a reception or a party or something. I can't remember how I got invited or why I was there. And I was talking to this woman who got into a conversation about education, and I was expounding on my views of education and black children or whatever. And it turned out she was principal of Washington High School. She said, we need somebody to start next week, so as a substitute teacher, so why don't you come?
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, right.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and then why did you go onto the truck?
Extra money.
Oh.
I wasn't doing anything else. I tend to want to fill my life up with stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I was never afraid of work. You know, like some people say, I would never work at McDonald's. I would work at McDonald's. I don't have a problem with that. This guy would haul stuff and junk and help people move. And... he was an interesting old black guy, and I thought it was cool.
And so then you got this job for the state of Georgia.
Right.
What were you doing?
Developing a mathematical model to estimate the need for general short stay hospital beds in the state of Georgia.
Wow.
So that formula was used for many years to determine whether hospitals should be given a certificate of approval for building or expansion.
Your formula that you developed?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
You're a publisher?
No. Oh, they haven't published anything. I didn't care. And then I wanted to improve this model using a matrix-based approach. Sort of the ideas that I had been thinking about when I did the relationship between using counties as units of observation. But that was giving an estimate that was, in my mind, more precise, but smaller than the original linear model that I gave them, developed. And they didn't want to have a model that produced estimates that restrictive. So they said, well, we'll just pay you for another year. Thanks a lot.
My goodness.
Yeah.
Even without even staying there?
I went in from time to time, but I didn't need to stay there. They had already, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, so now this is like 79?
Yeah, by this time it's like 79, 80.
And
yeah, 79, yeah.
It's getting on late, so I don't want to get too much longer.
Right.
But I do want to find out how you got into the CDC and how you finished your dissertation.
Right.
And then I'll let you go.
That's all Gladys Reynolds. Gladys Reynolds was my most ardent mentor, I think. So
when did you meet Gladys?
What?
How did you meet Gladys?
Oh, Gladys used to teach experimental design and the biometry program at Emory in the summer after lunch. Now, you know how Gladys's voice is, right?
But how did you get into the summer program at Emory after lunch? I mean, what?
I was in the biometry program, remember?
Oh. You mean you met Gladys right after Morehouse?
There you go.
Oh.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that you went back that far.
Yeah.
Did you stay in touch with her at all?
No. Not at all. And I don't know how she found that I was in Atlanta. Maybe I went to an ASA meeting or something like that. I don't know how she found out I was in Atlanta. But she called me and said, we need to talk. And I went out and we had this wonderful lunch. And CDC was in a hiring freeze. So no one had been hired in a full-time position at CDC for something like 3 years. And people were standing in line to who would work in their temporary position waiting for a full-time position. And I don't know how she did it, but I was the first higher after the freeze. That's Gladys Reynolds.
Wow.
She was relentless. And then, so when I came, she said, okay, so, dissertation, right? She said, well, you need to finish this by next year. So I needed to finish it by 1982.
So and this was 81 that you got the position at CDC?
This was 81 that I got the position at CDC. Yeah, maybe late 80 and early 81, yeah. And
so were you working for Gladys?
Yeah, I was working for Gladys.
And she was in the office of the director, is that?
She had her own branch. She was a branch chief.
Oh.
Yeah.
Which branch?
Statistics and something. What was the other name? What was the name of my section? I can't remember.
I'll find out from her.
Yeah, right. And so she was on my case, you know. So how are we doing with that dissertation, Bill? Blah, blah, blah. When are we going to talk about it again? Blah, blah. So I just said, to hell with this thing. I'm going to go and finish this dissertation. So I went in and basically finished it after, I don't know, a few months.
You went up to, you came back to Chapel Hill.
I drove back and forth to Chapel Hill.
You drove back 82, and forth?
Yeah, 82. She gave me time to do that.
Because that's when I remember seeing you in the student room working away.
Yeah, right. Because I had Gladys on my back, you know. And
And was Omran helping you or holding you back?
Of course. No. He was very... Unfortunately, Steve Polgar had died in the meantime. He was also a great, I don't know if you know the Polgar estimate.
I don't think I ever met him.
Steve Polgar was also an anthropologist, and he was one of the people who developed I think it's called a GSP or something like that, or P something. Estimate the family planning uses to estimate the need for family planning services. That was Stephen Polgar,
Was he in BIOS?
He was in anthropology.
Oh, here in
at UNC.
And he was on your committee?
He was on my committee. He was jogging right up behind the school and had a heart attack and died right there on Pittsburgh.
Ooh.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. So now I was down to five people on my committee. But Omron just, you know, went around, said, what's the problem? Okay, let's fix that. When somebody might say, well, I'm not sure, and he'd say, look, we need to finish this. So he was a master at getting what he wanted. He was very diplomatic, you know, and he would, you know, reminded you of Lyndon Johnson in a way, you know, but very goal-oriented. So I basically finished in 82 and got the degree in 83.
And one last question, mm-hmm. The Minority Health Conference.
Mm-hmm.
You said the first one was in fall of the winter of 77.
Yeah, I think so.
And you were involved in getting that one going.
Right.
And then you left after
that. And then I left after that. Right, yeah. And that, the guy, what was his name? He was the one who proposed this conference.
Who worked up in
Kelly,
City.
Bob Kelly. But then never did anything to get it off the ground. And I just said, well, let's just do it, you know. But in the end, while, you know, I may have been, you know, pushing for it, as it was the work of, you know, Jeannie and Vicky and Ethel and... You know, the women did all the work.
The women.
Yeah, right. You know, we took all the credit, but, you know, they did all the work. And then Jenny changed the whole thing. Jeannie and the Lumbee woman, what was her name? I can't remember what her name is right now.
Who was on faculty?
She was a student. Yeah, I can't remember. But anyway... when they became active with the conference, we could no longer be the Black Student Caucus. And we had become, with Jean Braybor and them participating in the survival course, you know, it already becoming minority. But it became really clear that we needed to change from the Black Student Caucus to the Minority Student Caucus,
mm-hmm.
with Jenny's involvement primarily, but also the fact that we had several Lumbee students participating.
Well, I've taken a lot of your time. It's been fascinating to hear these stories. And there were some surprises for me. It's not only things that I'd forgotten, there were things that I'd never heard before.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have to do this in reverse as well.
It's fine. Anytime you want, we can just play it in reverse.
No, I mean, you know what I mean.